We could start a little bit more informally. If any of you have any questions you'd like to ask, this would be a good time to ask questions. Or if you want to report how your meditation is going, this could be a good time just to let us know a little bit. Let me know. Yes, please.
I try to listen to mom, you know, every 5 minutes or 10 minutes. Set the timer to see where I'm at in my day. Every time the timer went off, my jaws were clenched tight. So it was really a wake-up call for me to pay attention.
Congratulations. So seeing your condition gives a possibility for you to change it. But if you didn't see it, you would probably go merrily along until...
I've probably done that for years. And
yeah. Good. I'm happy to hear that. There's a funny way in which Buddhist teachers are happy to hear when meditators suffer. You know, we don't want you to suffer, of course. So that's the whole point, is to help you not suffer. But we're happy because something like that is the path to becoming free. To see it. Is the first step. So other questions? Comments? Not to put any of you on the spot, but yes, please.
I noticed that when I'm focusing on keeping my tongue at the roof of my mouth, but I'm salivating a lot. I focus on salivating a lot. I keep swallowing. I'm sure that's a sign of tension.
And if you don't keep your tongue on the roof of your mouth, then you stop salivating?
I'm going to try that. I think trying to be good.
Oh, yeah. Why don't you try stopping that? If that stops the salivating, great. Then just, you know, the roof of the mouth is just optional. There are other reasons for salivating in meditation. It's not so uncommon, salivating in meditation. Especially when people are new. And so if for some reason you find it continues, even if you drop your tongue down off the roof of the mouth, it might just be something you have to be patient with for a while. It'll kind of adjust itself. So was it helpful? Last week I gave instructions on the body, mindfulness of the body. Was that helpful at home in practicing? Yeah. How did you find it helpful? Well, part of the reasons I ask these questions, why I like beginning to ask for questions and reports, is that it's easier for me to, when I talk, to be able to relate what I'm saying directly to you and what's going on with you. Otherwise, you know, if I'm just talking and I don't get anything back from you, then it's my guess who you are.
I'm only in a hospital now, and I constantly see people all the time who are totally surprised that they had a heart attack, or that they had a stroke. And it's kind of hard to believe if you just look at them, and they're so physically deteriorated that they must have had a clue a year ago or something like that. And being mindful of your body, it's kind of like you can tell when you're coming down with a cold. You can tell when you need more water, your kidneys aren't quite, getting enough water, and just being able to take care of yourself on a mundane basis, knowing when to eat, what not to eat, all these things can become obvious, when you take a look at your body. And if you don't take a look at your body, your body will move along until it stops, until there's something goes wrong with it. And then you sit back and go, gee, I don't know why. You know, I only eat French fries once a day. And a hamburger, just 4 or 5 times a week. I really don't know what's the matter, doctor. If you've been paying attention when you eat some certain foods that they create a problem, and normally one would say, well, if you eat that, it makes you sick, you don't eat it. But if you eat it and you don't notice that you are sick, you have a clue that you're sick. Well, then, of course, you're really sick because of the condition.
That's very important. The body provides a tremendous amount of information. It's so helpful in our lives. And there are people who don't, for various reasons, don't pay attention to their bodies. Some people because they're so busy in their heads or whatever activity. And some people as an act of denial. They don't want to. They actually intentionally shut off and close down parts of their body, go numb. And there's a direct connection between emotions in our body. And different emotions, we know we have an emotion generally because of how it feels in the body. If there was no bodily manifestation of an emotion, there probably wouldn't realize that you are having an emotion. There's such a strong correlation. And because of that strong correlation, if someone doesn't want to face their emotions or deal with them because they're too difficult or whatever, then they kind of repress that emotion, sometimes it has the secondary effect of numbing that part of the body where those emotions tend to be held. So I know I've met people who tell me that they have no feelings of their body below their neck or below their waist. And I mean, they know they have it. I mean, if you touch them, they feel something. But there's no awareness of there being something there. There's like this disembodied head that's going around. And they don't really know what they're feeling down here in their body. And if you don't feel your body well enough, you have very little access to feeling your emotions in a full way.
It seems you have a memory in your body as well.
There is, there's a kind of memory. Sometimes certain activities, certain emotions get held in our body in some way. And so so as the body relaxes, the places of holding get released. And with the releasing of that tension, the memory, the event that triggered that, gets released as a memory. So, for example, if you were in a car accident, and you tightened up in fear, but your body for some reason never really relaxed completely from that, and so there's always somewhere a little bit of tension still being carried. If that tension finally relaxes, sometimes a person might be flooded with memories of that accident. So in that sense, the memories are held. So one more question. I thought I saw another hand. No? Yes?
A friend of mine a while back, and I think she was coming from a Buddhist perspective when she said this, but she said that there's a difference between pain and suffering. And that just went right over my head, because to me, they're the same. They're so tightly bound together. I don't see a difference between them. And I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Well, it's a great one. Yeah, I'll take the opportunity now then to talk about it. I would have later. And so my wife is pregnant, and she's going to give birth in a few weeks. So she's pretty pregnant. And so she was reading this birthing book yesterday, and the person talked about in this book the difference between pain and suffering, and how pain is, part of the process. You're not going to, particularly help a woman have less pain in childbirth, in a normal birthing. But you can help the woman not suffer because of it. And suffering is, they might feel shame, or they might feel judgment, or they might feel aversion. They might feel all these attitudes about the pain. And the attitudes is what causes, the mental anguish. The pain is the pain. So the book my wife was reading yesterday, had an exercise for the women to try. There's a series of exercises having to do with an ice cube. So I tried it. And I didn't do all of it, but you might try it at home. I've thought about not incorporating it as part of my teaching, but I thought that we would make the mess of the floor here. And the idea is to, you take an ice cube, and you grab it in your fist, hold it kind of tight, and then you hold it in your palm for a minute. So I did it. It was pretty intense. And then you'd be mindful of what happens. And first you try to just be mindful of, don't try to be wise about it. Don't try to be kind of, just notice your kind of gut reaction to having all this pain. The ways you try to escape it, the way you want to, maybe you're a whiner, and that's how you deal, you complain about it. Or maybe you're trying to run away, or maybe you hate it, and you get angry, and you start hitting your fist against the wall. Or, there's all these attitudes we have about pain that come into play. And my attitude with my wife, I was holding it and said, was, are you sure this is safe? You know, I'm not going to get, frostbite or, you know, is this really okay? You know, so this doubt arose, you know, is this okay? You know, is this really okay? So then I stopped and there was this red ring, you know, around my, you know, I said, just look what happened. And within a couple of minutes, it was gone. So apparently, it's a safe thing to do. And it was very intense. And then that book encouraged you then to try to bring mindfulness to it and see if you can detach the attitude you have with the raw pain itself. Just let the pain be a pain. And the interpretation, the fear about, you know, frostbite and, you know, all these things are extra. And, you know, just the pain in and of itself.
Well, see, to me, the sensation of pain is suffering.
But you're saying
that there's actually something, another layer there that is causing suffering.
It depends how you want to define the words. Buddhists, in Buddhist language, pain just comes with being a human being. You stub your toe, your back goes out, someone dies and you feel grief. There's a lot of pain that just comes with being a human being. In Buddhist terminology, suffering refers to the relationship, the pain that arises by the relationship you have with your pain. And we can say it a little bit more precisely, from the relationship you choose to have. It's optional. So pain is not optional, but suffering is optional. Because it has to do with this way we relate to what's going on. If I tell you that, if I say that women who wear white sweaters are just, they must, I think they're the greatest. You might not see the suffering that produces in you. Suddenly you might, you know, it's just a statement. And you might think, oh, now all this attention has been drawn on me. Now people are going to notice a stain on my sweater. Or you say, oh, yes, this is great. The teacher seems to like me, And that's also kind of suffering. The happiness of kind of being elated masks the fact that there's some clinging and holding on there. We've related in a way that is actually adding a kind of suffering to the psyche. Or it could be. So a lot of what mindfulness practice is helping us do is to try, help us look at where is it that what's the relationship we're having with this experience right now? And is this a necessary relationship given what's happening? Or is it an interpretation? Or is it extra? So last week we talked about seeing the commentary as being different than direct experience. And the commentary then is not just often is not just simply ideas and thoughts, but is often then an emotional reaction also. So I've sat with a lot of physical pain and suffered, of course. But I've also sat with a lot of physical pain in meditation, for example, and had the mind not only be equanimous and peaceful, but actually had the mind filled with joy and rapture. Being in physical pain doesn't mean that your mind can't be peaceful or joyful or concentrated or something. So what happens to the mind, you have to have a trained mind to do that. You have to have a mind which has a fair degree of concentration and discipline. But you also have to have a mind that's very familiar with its own tricks. And the mind will have all these tricks. In one period of being in a very intensive retreat environment, meditation retreat environment, where it was almost, the whole situation was almost set up for physical pain. It's kind of unusual. You probably never encounter such a retreat environment. I can tell you, some of you might want to come to this play. This Friday evening, there's going to be a play here. And there's a woman, an Israeli woman, who went to Thailand and sat a one-month retreat, doing basically the practice that we teach. However, in this particular monastery, it's quite unusual to do this. After 27 days or so of intensive retreat, meditating all the time, they do the last 3 days of the retreat, they do determination sittings, where they don't sleep for 3 days. They just sit, meditate nonstop for 3 days. They eat, I guess, probably. And so I was told, I was warned, saying that play, you realize that this is not a normal kind of retreat, that as a play kind of builds, at the end of the retreat, there's a certain kind of gets a little bit crazy or a little bit climatic or whatever, builds in intensity. Because a particular retreat that she was on had this determination sits at the end. So anyway, you might want to come. It's kind of interesting to get a vantage point of one person's experience of being on a meditation retreat for a whole month. And it's part humorous and part serious. But I remember once sitting in such a kind of situation like that and having intense pain and not being able to move. Wasn't allowed to move. That was kind of the rule. And the only way I could survive was I had to be very, very attentive to in every moment to what my mind was going to do. The judgments, the aversions, the self-pity, the hate, whatever, you know. Because I had to notice it when it first arose. If I caught it just when it arose, I wouldn't buy into it. And it would just go away. And I'd be ready for the next moment. But if I relaxed my vigilance, then my mind took off. Self-pity took off and all these aversions and hates. And then the pain got so much worse. Because there's a feedback loop sometimes with our pain. That sometimes the relationship we form with the pain makes the pain stronger. And you can see it sometimes quite clearly because you might feel physical pain someplace and you notice you're tensing around it. And the tension sometimes is extra and you can relax it. Physical pain is a very valuable teacher in the spiritual life because it really helps highlight all the reactivity that we bring to it. And very few other things help do that as clearly. So, you know, if you're new to meditation, I don't encourage you to sit with pain until you kind of get a hang of meditation and begin to enjoy it for its own sake. But at some point in a meditative career, doing a lot of meditation, you might want to experiment with sitting with physical pain. Not to the point of being discouraged, and certainly not to the point of injuring yourself, but you might want to sit with it. And there's a lot of benefits that come with exploring that edge. And then one of the benefits might be that you'll find yourself in a situation where you can't go to a doctor, you can't go get an aspirin, you can't get, you know, just you're stuck with this physical pain. And you have now you have the skills of how to work with it directly. And I've been in situations like that where I was, you know, intense physical pain. And I, you know, just simply couldn't get any relief in the normal kind of conventional ways. And I was so grateful for my practice that I had the familiarity with my mind, I had the practice, and I'd practiced with pain in the past, and so I knew what to do with it, and I can keep my peace. And I found what happened recently to me, a couple of years ago it happened, I had a really intense headache. I was driving down from San Francisco. I guess I could have gotten off the freeway and probably, you know, I felt it wasn't even safe to drive. It was so intense. I was nauseous and intense headache. And maybe I should have gotten off and gotten aspirin or coffee or something, but I wanted to get home. But what I noticed, I had to rely on my mindfulness practice, be very attentive to what was going on in the moment. And then I stayed cool and peaceful. But if I relax my attention, I let my mind wander, then the nausea and the headache would come pounding back in a much more intense way. So I was so grateful to have had the practice to keep me, you know, centered and cool. Yes?
So is part of what you were saying that your relationship to pain is suffering, the relationship?
It doesn't have to be. You can have a healthy relationship to pain. But an unhealthy relationship to pain is suffering. It causes suffering and can cause more pain.
So in the Buddhist way, is that what that means? Suffering is your relationship to your emotions, not just pain.
You could say in Buddhism, the Buddhist definition of suffering arises out of unhealthy ways of relating to your experience. So if you're clinging to the experience, you're suffering. So it's very interesting because clinging causes suffering in the moment when you're holding tight. And then it sets up a habit formation of tending to cling more easily. So, for example, you might have noticed that, some of you, that if you do the same thing over and over again, like repeatedly, I notice it cleaning my house sometimes. If I get a little bit of frenzied cleaning, and I'm going around trying to do many different things and trying to sort things out and whatever, you know, do. And I get into this kind of a little bit not a frantic is too strong a word, but kind of this, like, you know, into this cleaning mode, you know, like this doing. And then I, for some reason I stop, or like everything's cleaned, whatever. I can still feel the momentum inside of me to keep looking for something to clean. Like I can't relax so quickly because the momentum is there. So clinging causes suffering in the moment of doing it. And it often sets up a momentum in some way of tending to do it more in the future. Like habit formation. Mm-hmm. And so it can be a form of clinging, and it could also be the form of pushing away or trying to pull ourselves away or setting up resistance in some way. So there's all kinds of ways in which we unhealthily relate in unnecessary ways to our experience. And one of the reasons why mindfulness is so powerful is that mindfulness itself is a practice of only being aware of what the experience is. And so the reference point that all I'm supposed to do here is to pay attention highlights all the other things that the mind wants to do. And so you can see that much more clearly. And resolve them, deal with them, settle them. And then in time, find how to bring the mind to peace. There are other ways of bringing the mind to peace. You can get a good massage, you can listen to music, you can have, you know, go for a run, and you can think of all kinds of wonderful ways. You can, you know, bring the mind, kind of make it joyful and peaceful or whatever. They're fine in and of themselves, those ways. But the problem with those ways is that it's taking something external, and external things kind of prompting or encouraging, massaging the mind to become peaceful. And so the tendencies to become agitated are still there. And mindfulness is trying to look at very honestly. One of the things mindfulness is trying to do is very honestly at what's really going on in ourselves and learning the skills of looking at it directly and facing it directly and not needing to have other props to bring the mind to peace. And because of that, the peace the mind comes to is much more resilient because you've done the personal work that supports that peace. But if every time you feel agitated, you go get a massage, you're not learning anything about really yourself. If you feel agitated, you run back to the masseuse. And that's not it's an expensive way of living a life. Am I making some sense? Yes?
Can you talk about paying attention to the emotions?
Yeah.
Can you talk about the difference between paying attention to the emotion and feeling and then sort of taking it to the cause of that emotion? What might have brought that emotion up in you?
That's a big topic. Any kind of wise life involves some kind of reflection about the causes and conditions that come into play. And so there's a time for reflecting on that. In meditation practice itself, we're not reflecting back in time. What are the causes and conditions in the past? What we're trying to understand is the causes and conditions for our suffering right now, or our emotion right now. So if you're angry, the condition for the anger might be that someone said something unkind to you yesterday. It might be helpful to realize that. But in Buddhism, we say that's the condition for your anger, for your suffering. If we don't want to, in Buddhism, in this kind of strict way of looking, you don't want to blame that person for your suffering. That person's only the condition for it. It was optional, but whether you pick that up. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can only touch me, right? So, but you know, somehow it touched you because you grabbed onto it. So the cause of suffering is not, that person's the condition. The cause is how you picked it up. If you're suffering today based on what happened yesterday, then the cause of that suffering is still happening right now. You're still clinging. So in meditation, we don't look back in time to understand. We just try to look very clearly in what's happening in the present. And we say that for purposes of meditation, looking into the past gets in the way of the process of settling the mind, bringing the mind to peace. After meditation, you might think about it, or therapy or something. Does that make sense? One of my teachers said that when you meditate, there's nothing whatsoever you need to think about. And I find that very helpful. Because, you know, the mind wants to think, right? Oh, not, I don't really need to think about that. What I'm having for dinner, or what I'm supposed to, you know, a better rejoinder to, for the conversation I had yesterday, or where I'm supposed to go on vacation, you know. Or... Yes?
Can we discuss more the separation between the thought and the self? Meaning you, you say things like the familiarity with the self and when someone tricks or commands with more thoughts. It's somewhat paradoxical that thoughts and the suppression of thoughts are somewhat liberating the self.
Are
liberating oneself.
I'd rather not go there. Buddhism doesn't. It's not in Buddhism. We tend to use the word self very conventionally, just easily. You know, if I have an itch, it's my own itch. You know, it's myself. I have to deal with it. I don't go and scratch your cheek. You know, so that, you know, it's kind of conventionally. I'm here, and you know, it's myself here. But to get into the philosophical notion of what the self is and all that, generally Buddhists don't want to deal with that. It's not like very interesting. You know, it's very interesting for other people. If you really want to look at the Buddhist, my take on the Buddhist view of this, you can read my article in our current newsletter. And if it's, you know, where I try to address this. But generally, the Buddhist approach is in meditation itself. It's limited to there. It's a waste of your time to be engaged in any kind of thinking about the self and the true self and better self and improved self. And just more thoughts, more overlay. Now, some of us are addicted to the self, of course. And so any kind of idea of, you know, giving up or thinking about myself is, you know, you have to go through a period of fear because, you know, who am I then? So today, we already started, we're going to talk about emotions and how to incorporate emotions as part of the mindfulness practice. What I'd like to do is start with a sitting. So if you'd like to stand, you've been sitting now for half an hour and stretch a little bit. This would be a good time. So in the last two sessions, I gave you instructions on how to set up for meditation, which can be useful. I think it's useful sometimes to take a few long, slow, deep breaths. It's useful to spend some time checking in with your body and perhaps relaxing some of the obvious tension in your body that you're holding. There's various kind of ways you can set yourself up to begin, kind of get more settled when you meditate. But I also I don't want to give you the impression, however, that the only way you can be mindful is after having set yourself up. You can be mindful in a moment. Just, you know, what's happening right now is the basic question. So in that spirit, I'm going to kind of do something like this. So you first close your eyes. And then just as you are right now, how are you feeling? What's the emotional state, the mood, the mental state that's present for you? There'll always be one might be very subtle. You could be calm or agitated, happy or sad, contented or impatient, annoyed or delighted, peaceful, worried. And then as you're aware of your mood or mental state, your emotional state, see if you can discern or notice what your relationship is to its presence. Are you happy that it's there? Are you surprised? Are you aversive to it? Do you judge it? Do you have any conclusions that you live by about it? This means that, I'll always be this way, or this means that if this continues, this is going to happen. How do you relate to it? How simple can you become? Can you let go of the relationship? Just let it be by itself. It's okay. Like it has, like your emotional state has complete permission to be here as it is. And then notice where in your body your emotional state or mood is most manifest. There'll be somewhere. Maybe mostly in the face or mostly in the torso, the shoulders, throat, the stomach. It could be a very large area of the body. It could be a small area. Could be around the eyes, cheeks, shoulder blades. Could be the chest, the heart area. It could be the arms or the hands. And very matter-of-factly, simply as you can, hang out with the sensations in your body that seem to relate to having your the particular mood you're in. And as you do that, notice what changes there are, if any, in the sensations, in your mood. And then now, almost as if you're starting over again, take a few long, slow, deep breaths, using the in-breath to connect with your body, the out-breath to relax the body. Long, slow, deep breaths from deep down in the belly, filling your torso as you breathe in. And then let your breath return to normal. Might look through your body and if there's any obvious places that it's really simple to relax. Shoulders, belly, face. You can soften that part of your body. And then within your body, as part of your body, become aware of your breathing. Become aware of how your body experiences your breathing. The lifting and falling of the belly or the chest. The expansion of the rib cage. Sensation of air moving in and out through your nostrils. Wherever it's easiest to experience your breathing, let your attention rest there. Part of the value of the breathing, mindful breathing, is allowing the breathing, the steadiness, the ongoingness of the breath, the repetition of one breath after the other, to help settle and center the mind, body, heart, to help you get relaxed. If you find yourself getting sleepy, then you might want to emphasize the inhalation or feel the upwelling with the in-breath. Upwelling of up through the chest, the spinal column. Let there be energy in the system from the in-breath. But if you feel like it'd be nice to be calmer, relax with the out-breath. Let go of your thoughts and concerns. Just breathing in and out. Let your emphasis be with being with the breath. Letting go of the commentary and thoughts you have. Or let them be in the background, in the foreground of attention. Just being with each breath. Being with a rhythm of one breath following another. And now, as you're coming to the end of the sitting, let go of your breathing. And once again, check in and see what is the mood or the emotional state that's present for you. How is it different from before? If you can recognize a mood or emotional state very softly, like a gentle whisper in the mind, name it a few times with a single word. Feel the bodily aspects of it. How does it manifest itself energetically or physically, sensation-wise? And then take a few long, slow, deep breaths. And then when you're ready, you can open your eyes and end the sitting. So it's always helpful to remember that mindfulness meditation is meant to be very simple. And it's very simply bringing awareness to what's happening in the present moment. Because the mind is often very agitated or busy, it can be helpful to have a central focus for that attention. It's a place to stabilize the attention. Sometimes it's called the anchor for attention or the home base for attention. And for many people, the breath works really well as that. For some people, the breath doesn't work. But the breath works really, generally works very well. And but then we're ready. If something else becomes more compelling than the breath, to leave the breath and let that attention go to the other thing that's happening in the present moment that's more compelling. And the analogy I like to use is that of a spider in a spider's web. Spider sits in the middle of the web and waits for something to happen on the web. And then something happens elsewhere, an insect lands and gets stuck. The spider leaves the center of the web and goes and attends to what's there. It's very mindful of what's over there. And then after it's finished being mindful, it comes back into the middle. We live in the web of our experience. In Buddhist terminology, we sometimes call it a mandala, kind of a circular kind of pattern, and we sit at the middle. We sit at the middle of that mandala, which is the breath. And if something else happens in the web of our experience, we're quite content to leave our breath and go attend to, be mindful of what else is going on. If it's physical experience, sensations or sounds, then we go and bring our attention to those. And there's no physical sensation which is considered inappropriate or wrong for mindfulness practice. Just another place to pay attention. Whatever is the compelling, whatever is the predominant experience, is where the attention rests. the meditative awareness. Meditative awareness is trying to come to that non-reactive awareness that only sees what's there, only recognizes, brings presence to what's there, without all the added addition of complicated relationships and reactivity. Emotions are an important part of our lives, expected part of our lives. When emotions become predominant, which they will sooner or later, they become part of the meditation. Some people are feeling, oh, not that emotion. I'm supposed to be a meditator. I'm not supposed to be feeling that or whatever. There's no emotion which is unacceptable for meditation. You might have the idea, well, this is unspiritual. How unspiritual could I get? I'm just consumed with lust. You know, this shouldn't be happening. Or I'm consumed with anger and rage. Whatever the emotion is, in meditation itself, it's acceptable. And you're given permission to feel it completely as it is. To judge it negatively or feel like it shouldn't be there. Or conversely, if you have some great rapture and delight, to judge that it should be there, that now you've got it made, whatever. All that is extra. So we give permission for the difficulty and the joy, whatever the emotion is, we give it permission to be there as it is, and we try not to complicate it. Just to see it, just let it be there, bring simple presence. This is how it is. It's a safe place to do that because in meditation you're not going to punch out your neighbor because you're not going to move, right? So you can be filled with, you know, anger, and you know you're not going to act on it. So it's a safe place just to let it kind of course through you. And then, so we don't bring attention to it. Now, with emotions, they're kind of tricky because there tends to be a lot of commentary, a lot of ways in which we identify with the emotions or get all kinds of conclusions about it or get kind of lost in it or, you know, caught up in it and whatever. And often the emotions is there, sometimes emotion is there, because we're already caught up in some concern. So there's often a lot of mental concern, the story making that can go with emotions. So it can be hard to bring meditative awareness to it because what we tend to do is bring story making to it. Or story making, you know, is where we're lost in. And so, you know, if we're angry with someone, you know, we don't just bring attention to the anger that we're feeling. We're still talking, you know, repeating the conversation and fixing it and justifying why, you know, what it is. We're still caught up in the story making, which sometimes is re-traumatizing. Oh, someone said once, forgiveness is giving up all hope for a better past. What do you think of that? Forgiveness is giving up all hope for a better past. So just to be here with the present moment with the emotion as it actually is. It's difficult. So we have a number of ways to help us do this. One is to remind yourself that it's important to recognize what the emotion is. And sometimes we kind of know what's there, or we don't really know, we're so caught up in the stories, or sometimes we want to deny it's there. But to clearly recognize that emotion is happening is very helpful. Sometimes that in itself can be liberating. Oh, that's what it is. Sometimes the emotion releases itself when it's kind of named and recognized. It's kind of like the stories of the ancient dragons. If you name the dragon, it loses its power. It's kind of like the part of the mind that can name something, recognize clearly, is a different part of the mind that's caught by stuff. And by emphasizing the naming, the recognizing part of the mind, you're recognizing actually a part of the mind which is actually kind of strong and independent, not caught by things. So it helps kind of find the freedom. If you just name it, this is what it is. With my 4-year-old son, I try to do that for him sometimes. If he's having some difficult emotion or whatever, strong emotion, sometimes I like to name it for him. If it's obvious, you know, I don't want to name it wrongly, but if it's really obvious, oh. Sometimes I'm not sure, I'll give him some options. The other day he was a little bit angry with me, and he was given a sword, a little wooden, very balsa wood kind of sword at his school. And so he came out kind of swinging the sword towards me. And so I said, oh, are you feeling angry or sad? It didn't work, but But you know, I was trying to help him by, you know, by naming it. But maybe it worked because he stopped. You know, I named it. Maybe that was enough. And then so that's the first thing, is recognize it. The other thing that's very helpful is to accept it. And for a lot of people, it can be very hard to accept their emotions. But practice is, in this setting, at least in meditation, it can be helpful outside of meditation too, but at least in meditation, have this radical acceptance of your emotion. Like it's complete permission to be there. It's okay. You can have murderous rage. You want to kill your parents. It's meditation. It's okay. But not afterwards. Don't go on, you know. Afterwards, you know, be wise about it. But in meditation, and the idea is to get out of its way. Acceptance is a way of getting out of its way. Because what happens is that often emotions are fueled by our involvement with the emotion. We're actually feeding it constantly. An emotion won't stay intact through time unless we re-feed it, re-nourish it. And we re-nourish it by getting involved in it and justifying it, and, you know, all kinds of ways. So acceptance is very much the opposite of feeding it. It's like, okay, just I'll let it be there, it's okay, but I'm not going to keep engaging in it in any kind of way. So the story. In ancient times, there seemed to be these beings called yakshas. This is in India. And yakshas are kind of like, and this one was a really ugly one. And I kind of translate it as a runt, an ugly, or a troll, an ugly runt of a troll. And back in ancient India, they also had these gods. And there was a supreme god called Brahma. And he lived on this, he had this throne in his palace. And one day he went away from his palace, and this ugly little runt of a troll climbed up on his throne. And all the other gods in the court got really upset and got angry. You have to get down from there. You're not supposed to be there. That's only for the great god Brahma, and you shouldn't be there. And as they were getting angry with him and telling him to get down, he started growing. And he got bigger and bigger and more beautiful, more radiant and stronger and bigger. So finally the gods got kind of frustrated and confused by this. So they went and found Brahma and explained to him what had happened. He said, oh, I know what to do. Come with me. So he went back to his throne and he stood in front of his throne, in front of this now beautiful big troll, and said to the troll, I'm so glad to see you. And he bowed to him and I hope you're well. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for you. And just offered him all this kindness and respect. And as he did that, the troll shrunk and shrunk and got smaller and smaller and more ugly and got smaller and smaller, and finally, poof, it disappeared. Then Brahma went up on his throne and he explained, this troll, this little yaksha, is an anger-eating yaksha troll. And if you get angry, it just grows and grows and grows. But if you don't feed it anger, then it starves, it disappears. So sometimes our emotions are fueled by how we relate to them. We feed them. And so, for example, if you hate your particular emotion, paradoxically, sometimes that hate can actually feed the continuation of it. So acceptance is a very powerful phenomenon. When you accept an emotion, you're actually pulling the rug from underneath the way we feed it sometimes. So recognizing acceptance. The third thing is to be interested in investigating it. And one of the most useful places to investigate is to feel it in your body. What's the bodily, physical manifestation of the emotion? As I said earlier, all emotions are manifested in the body, or seemingly all. And so where is that? And if you can find a place in the body where the emotion resides, the body is not a story. So you can connect directly to that emotion through the body and not worry about getting lost in the stories as long as you're with the body. So if you have, you know, overwhelming fear, the fear will be felt someplace in your body. You connect to the bodily part of it. Where's that fear in your body? Tight stomach. And it might be what you're afraid about seems, you know, really difficult. But is your tight stomach difficult? And you might be able to have the courage to stay and hang out with a tight stomach. And then you can learn to kind of accept that, be with that. Bring your careful attention to those sensations. What's that like? What's your relationship to it? Can you be really simple with it? Just tightness. What happens as you're present for tightness? It might soften. It might get tighter. Your job is simply to notice how it changes. Then it might change, and you might have a judgment of how it's changing. Oh, no, it's getting stronger. That's extra. Just leave it, let it be. Let it be as it is. It's going away. Great. That great is extra. Just let it go. You know, just be really simple. That's what helps the mind become peaceful. To be very simple with how things are. So recognize clearly, accept it, and investigate it. That's what we do with emotions. If the emotion goes away or is no longer compelling, then you go back to the breathing. That's simple. What we're looking for is uncomplicated emotions. Now that's a very, now be very careful what I say here, because we have, say I get angry. And then what happens is I get embarrassed because I'm angry. Because I'm a Dharma teacher, you know, meditation teacher, I'm in front of all these people, and I shouldn't, you know, be an angry person. I should know better. So now I'm embarrassed. But then I'm embarrassed, but I'm not just embarrassed. Then because I'm embarrassed, I get angry with myself for being embarrassed one more time. How can I keep being so embarrassed all the time? I should know better than being embarrassed. And then I feel in despair. I'm going through a cycle of anger and embarrassment and anger again. Oh, it's hopeless. So despair arises. And then fear arises through the despair. Oh my God, I'm always going to be this way. There's never any way out for me. Oh, if I continue this way, I'll probably never be able to hold a job again. No one will ever come and listen to me. And it'll be terrible. And then I'm filled with fear. So there's ways in which sometimes there's generations of reactivity. And the sad thing is sometimes we're living at the 120th generation. And then you listen to Gil give his talk about being uncomplicated with your emotions, and you're living at 120. And he's talking about just let the anger be the anger. So, oh, and then you add 100, then you add, you know, complication number 121. Oh my God! Now I'm not doing meditation right even. I didn't even know that. That wasn't even an issue before I took this class. And now, you know, 100. And so this happens. The point is, we wake up and accept wherever we can. And if it's the 132nd generation away from the primary thing, that's fine. That's where you can do it. That's where you begin. And then slowly over time, you'll learn to get earlier and earlier and earlier. And finally, you find, you know, just anger can be anger, or whatever the primary thing, just be the primary thing and no complications. Does all that make sense? Any questions? Is it that clear? Do you have a sense of what you might do now in meditation when an emotion arises? Yes, please.
Do you recommend something we could do to prevent ourselves from being reacting to the fact that we're accepting an emotion?
Reacting to the fact that you're accepting, you mean like congratulate yourself? I think the principle in mindfulness is the antidote to the first antidote we try to everything is simply seeing very clearly what's actually happening and not making it a problem. So one of the principles, what I'm saying in shorthand is, when you sit and meditate, don't make anything a problem. So if you have any kind of reactivity that happens, if it's already happening, don't make it a problem. Just clearly recognize, oh, this is happening now. So you will have complicated reactions and to what's happening. Don't then suffer more because of that. Just take what's given. Whatever is given, whatever has actually already happened or is in the process of happening in the moment, clearly recognize and see this is what's happening. So if you're reacting to the fact that you're accepting, if that's already happening, then clearly see that's the case. And that is healing. It's liberating. That actually helps dramatically. And it's an amazing process to be involved in. The process of radical acceptance of the present moment, regardless of what it is. Not seeing anything as a problem. Not seeing anything as the solution. Just letting things be as they are, uncomplicated. It pulls the rug from so much of our lives. So much of our lives can be built upon non-acceptance and reactivity. And to do this radical thing of non-reactivity and acceptance, can just the whole house of cards can fall. Does that make sense as an answer to your question? Yes.
Sometimes it's hard to feel what we're feeling or to find it.
So two things. Is first, that can be the case. And you don't want to strain trying to find. Partly with mindfulness, we try to be with what's obvious. And if what's obvious is you're feeling yucky, but you don't know exactly what feeling it is, be content that now you're becoming a connoisseur of what it feels like to be yucky. You feel kind of vaguely something is off. Okay, just what does that feel like? And unsure, you know. So sometimes people say, where do you feel that in your body? Some emotion they're having. And they say, oh, I don't know, it's everywhere. I say, oh, okay. Is it happening in your little toe? No. It's mostly, then they say, oh, it's mostly in my torso. And suddenly they narrowed it. Okay, now where in the torso? Is it mostly in the front of the torso and the back of the torso? Oh, it's mostly in the front. And how is it there? Oh, it's a lot of tightness or vibration or warmth. And so then sometimes you have to kind of, you know, it takes a while to kind of find your way. But the first thing is just don't strain to investigate. Just take what's obvious and just investigate what's obvious. Don't try to look behind what's obvious. As you be with what, so let's say emotions are often, as I said, kind of build on each other. Don't go digging. Like if you feel angry, don't go digging for an emotion that might be underneath that's stimulating the anger. Get to know the anger really, really well. And as you do that, you notice in the cracks of the anger something deeper. So I did this once, a story I tell a lot. I used to live up on Skyline, up in the mountains here. And I would come home at night after teaching like this. And sometimes people would have the high beams driving against me at night. And so I kind of would be blinded a little bit. And I noticed that I would get angry. And so I started getting interested in this anger that happened. So I started paying careful attention to that anger. So I got lots of opportunities. So I had lots of opportunities to look at my anger. And as far as I could tell, high beams would come towards me. I'd get angry, irritated. But I kept looking. At some point, I saw much more clearly. And it wasn't like I was looking for something. I was just trying to pay careful attention to what was going on. But then I saw through the crack of the anger. And I saw a moment before the anger, there was fear. And it was the fear that was a trigger for the anger. And after I learned to see the fear, then when I drove, I could abide in the fear. And the fear wouldn't have to become anger. And the fear was enough motivation to pay attention, you know, be careful as I was driving. So that one thing is, you know, this, you know, just be with what's obvious. And the other thing is, if you can feel it in your body, trust your body. Even if you might not recognize, you know, what emotion it is, trust how you're feeling it in the body. And just follow the body sensation of it. Follow what happens. Track what happens in your body as you in the body with that particular feeling. Sometimes in meditation, you sit down to meditate, and it just overwhelming. There's so much is happening at once. It's chaos. Confused. You're totally confused. I can't find my breath. I can't find emotion. I can't find body sensation. Don't look. Just become mindful of confusion. Just say, this is chaos. And become aware of what chaos feels like. And then with time, you'll begin, and what's my relationship to chaos? I hate it. I'm afraid of it. And then suddenly you're engaged with it and beginning to find your peace in the middle of it. Does that make sense? Now, the idea is not to be busy in meditation. It's kind of like the center of your mandala is this light bulb that's been covered by black cloth or something. Well, I'll use a different analogy, which is kind of a Buddhist one. Imagine yourself sitting in a one-room house, and there's a door that's open and five windows which are open. In the middle of that one-room house, there's an easy chair. And you're sitting in that easy chair, very relaxed, very much at ease. And then you notice that periodically things come to your door, come to your window. But you don't have to leave your easy chair to notice what arises. But when it arises, you study it and see it until it goes away. You don't get out of your chair and go look out the door and go down the trail looking for what's, you know, trouble or whatever. You just stay in your easy chair and things come. That's kind of the principle of mindfulness meditation. You sit down in some modicum of way, make yourself at ease, and you just let things reveal themselves to you. Keep your mind that easy. So you try to stay centered on your breath. You try to have some discipline with your breath. But if something else comes in through one of the doors, sense doors, if a physical sensation arises, if an emotion arises, let it come in. Let it come into that window and then study that, get to know it. But don't leave your easy chair. Does that make sense? So this meditative awareness where you try to be at ease with whatever is going on. If all this seems like too much, what I've said so far, trust your breath. Just go back to your, just be with your breathing. You can really, it's really a powerful thing to trust. Until the kind of instructions I'm saying become really obvious. There might be some time when it's glaringly obvious that you have this huge emotional outpouring which you can't ignore. Maybe then you bring these instructions into bear. But, you know, try to keep it, you know, as simple as you can. And if it sounds like it's too, you're being too busy with these instructions, err on the side of making it simpler for yourself. Just go back to the breath. Okay? What was it like, a short sitting we did? At the beginning, when I asked you to be aware of your emotions straight off, your mood, and you stayed with it for a while and explored it in your body and different things, did that, was it, what happened for some of you? Anything of interest? Yes?
I almost instantly cataloged a bunch of bodily complaints and was able to see that the sum total of them was my emotional state.
Great.
And that was sort of a startling revelation for me because it had never sort of occurred to me as one of those
great. Keep looking at that. Keep looking at that. That's a very, very important insight, and I would encourage you to kind of keep investigating that territory between your sensations and your emotional state. Someone else?
I was glad to hear what you said about what if there's an emotion under the emotions, just stick with the obvious one, because first I started just feeling a sense of relaxation and calm. And then my mind got busy and said, well, of course, you've been laid off, but really, you should be. And then my mind started going like wild horses chasing, you know, trying to find all these ways I should feel. You know, perhaps I should be afraid and all this other stuff. And then they came back and I went back to the calm, you know, just letting it be okay to be calm. It was very interesting.
Yes.
You said within a row, before I've come here, I've done an intense hour of aerobics. I'm wondering if I shouldn't do that, because what I noticed is it seems like this mask of feeling good because there's a lot of endorphins or whatever. So, you know, it's like, what am I really feeling? I'm feeling that post-aerobic semi-high. So should I not do aerobics before I meditate?
It reminds me of the story that I tell often in the intro class of these two monks in a monastery who wanted to smoke. And so the first went to the abbot and said, you know, can I smoke while I pray? And the abbot said, never. When you pray, just pray. So the poor monk left the office of the abbot kind of dejected, and he saw his friend and he said, no, nothing doing. his friend said, let me go in and ask. So he went and asked the abbot. He said, okay, if I pray while I smoke? Oh, yes, you should pray, you know, all the time in all your activities. You know, so it's a little bit hard for me to know how to answer your question directly. But you might experiment both ways and see which is most useful for you. But if it's not useful in the long run to rely on some kind of technique that gets your juices going, makes you feel really good, and then come into meditation, so the meditation only makes you kind of enjoy or you know, linger or stay in that. In a long-term meditation life, you want to be able to face all your life through your meditative awareness, the joys and the highs with the lows equally. And if you're only choosing the highs, then you're shortchanging yourself, because you want to be able to process your whole life, you look very honestly at the whole of who you are. And so some people will always be doing something to kind of pump them up, pump themselves up, and they kind of become addicts of always being pumped up through either caffeine or equivalents of other things. And exercise can be one of them. And sometimes it's better actually not to do anything at all that anything external, like exercise or coffee or anything that gets your system going up. Not to do any of that so that you can really see what your heart and mind is like by itself. And you'll over time, you'll see a tremendous, tremendous beauty there, and you'll see tremendous demons there. And part of the training is to learn how to face both. Not learn the wisdom of not choosing one over the other, but really facing your full humanity as it is, and in the process of doing that, becoming free. Does that make sense to you? So you have to decide what you want to do. But, you know, it's just a six-week class, so, you know, it's okay. I don't want you to change your routine so much. But if you're sitting every day at home, then that's where maybe, you know, if you sit up until the morning, get up when you sit in the morning first thing, you know, before you exercise, you're getting that.
Makes me think that it might be wise to experiment with meditating at different times of the day instead of, you know, trying to do it first thing in the morning and to be able to go to those places when maybe you're stressed or you've got other things going or whatever. And sort of for me, I think I need to assign different times of the day just to experiment with.
It's possible. If you have enough time, what I encourage you to do is to do the morning meditation as a real regular thing you do every morning. And then some days, an experiment adding meditation at different times in order to help you look at some areas of your life as they come up. The advantage of sitting every day in the morning, and then over the long term, whatever needs to go through your meditative life will come through it. And if you start choosing different times to sit, you're not necessarily the most reliable chooser. You know, the mind doesn't necessarily know. It's like a little kid, like, you know, who likes candy. The kid doesn't know when to stop eating candy before, you know, having a stomachache, right? The mind doesn't know sometimes how to take care of itself. And sometimes, so you need sometimes some kind of discipline that helps the mind step out of itself, its own choices and preferences. And having a daily sitting practice in the morning, for example, it's actually relatively consistent. I'm going to sit no matter what, this length of time in the morning, every morning this way, no matter what. It's not about my preferences. It's very, very powerful. So if you have enough time to do both, I'd encourage you to have the morning sitting and then add other times. Okay. I'd like us to end with a short sitting. If you would like to stand for a few seconds and just stretch. So gently close your eyes. And then take a few long, slow, deep breaths. Let your breath return to normal. And let your mind, let yourself, imagine you're sitting in an easy chair, very relaxed, at ease, nothing to do, nothing to become, nothing need to think about, at ease in the moment. And then let your breathing come to you. Become aware of your body's experience of breathing. And as you become aware of your breathing, try not to be hesitant about the breath or reserved or held back. Bring a kind of a full presence to the breathing. You probably have the experience of someone, one person talking with you who wasn't really present, and someone else who was really present. You really felt that they were there. In a relaxed way, see if you can really be there for each breath, each in-breath, each out-breath. Whatever is happening in the present moment, body sensations, emotions, the breath, see if you can be simple about it there, at ease, no problems, just bringing awareness, quiet, non-reactive awareness, recognizing what's happening in the present, breathing in, breathing out, body sensations, no matter how intense. Just be at ease. Emotions. And then periodically ask yourself or notice, what is the relationship that you might have with this experience? when the mind wanders away in thought, gently begin again with your breathing. The breath can be kind of like the default. Just begin there again. The breathing is always in the present moment. Doesn't matter how many times the mind wanders off in thought. It only matters that each time it does, you remember to come back again. Begin again. In my role as a meditation teacher, I've talked to a lot of people about their lives. And one of the themes that I've seen often enough is people who had difficult childhoods. And one of the most painful things that seems to arise, can arise in childhood, is if a child doesn't feel like they were seen by their parents or relatives. And what I've learned from these conversations is that being seen and being loved are just about the same. And I think of them as the same. So the process of insight, of seeing clearly, being clearly present for what's happening, this way of being non-reactive, very simple, allowing things to be as they are, but clearly seeing this is what's happening now. That act of seeing is a form of love. It's a way of bringing love to ourselves. So I hope that you treat yourself as being very precious and that you have tremendous respect for yourself, and that part of that expression of that respect and that love is bringing this non-reactive awareness, seeing clearly what's here. So next week we'll talk about thoughts and how to incorporate thinking as part of the mindfulness practice. And until then, please let go of anything you think about. Thank you.